Hi everyone, welcome to this new series of podcast Luxury Insight in collaboration with fashionnetwork.com. Today we're very lucky and honored to welcome Florian de Saint-Pierre, who's a leading talent scouter for luxury brands for over 20 years. Florian will share with us some secrets and amazing stories about how to find the best talents of tomorrow. So have a great podcast. Bye-bye.
Good morning. Florian de Saint-Pierre. I'm here with quite probably, almost certainly, the most famous headhunter in fashion and luxury in Western Europe, if not the world. Good morning to you, Florian.
Good morning, Godfrey.
Let's begin in the beginning. Where were you born and how did you get the first idea of working in fashion and luxury?
In fact, I am born in Brittany, in the west of France, but I've been raised in Paris. And I was passionate, in fact, by creative industries. I was passionate by what makes you buy something. What makes something desirable? And of course, the most obvious thing was fashion. So that's why I got passionate into fashion. And I knew very early that I wanted to work behind the scenes. So that's why I graduated in finance.
In fact, where did you study?
I studied in Lycée Janson de Sailly, and then I graduated from ESSEC, which was, one of the top, and which is one of the top business schools, and I enjoyed tremendously my time there. I went to Italy, I went to Australia, I went to travel the world, and then it was my first experience in fashion.
Because your first job, if I'm right, was working at Christian Dior.
Absolutely. I joined, in fact, as an intern in the finance department.
Well, when you were 20...
I was. In fact, I graduated from ESSEC at 20.
Oh, you did?
So
okay.
I was not even 20 when I joined as an intern. And Mr. Arnault just made the acquisition of the Groupe Boussac. Yeah. And there was Dior as a jewel. And so
before he'd even gone into LVMH.
Oh, yes. It was, at the time, it was called Financière Agache.
Yes.
And his first acquisition was, Christian Dior. Yeah. And so I sent my resume to the new finance director, who is absolutely amazing. And he recruited me as an intern. And I said, the minute I walked in, I said, I'm not going to leave. And I have not left for 7 years.
So then you stayed in Dior doing, what did you do there?
I was super lucky, super fortunate. I was working super hard, but I learned everything there. I joined the finance department, and then I was given, and this was amazing, to set up the control, so the finance follow-up, of the design teams. So this was just amazing. This really exposed me to creativity and how it works.
You said to finance the contracts of the design team.
Not the contracts. It was really everything, which was the budgets. And at the time, there was a design team in New York. There was a design team in Japan. And of course, there were design teams in Europe. So it was, budgets for the fashion shows, budget for the collections, budgets for the traveling, budgets for everything. And I was in charge of this. And then it went very well. Yeah. A few years later, I was given the budgeting and the control of the retail department in Europe. So it was the FD Montaigne and setting up all the financial follow-up, but also the acquisitions of the franchisees.
Because when you first started, I'm guessing Marc Bohan would have been the creative director. Is that right?
It's too much in the past. Let's talk about the future. Yeah. But yes, okay. It was Marc Bohan.
But that, and then you were there with the transition to Gianfranco Ferré.
To Gianfranco Ferré. And then I started my company in 1990. And because I was, headhunted by an executive search firm who was specialized in finance. So they contacted me and I am very curious. I had no intention to leave. I was super happy. But as a very curious person, I went there and I was offered to join them.
Yeah.
And Dior was my first client.
Oh, okay. So you joined this company outside?
I joined this company. Dior was my first client. And I really it was so helpful to have experience to know what companies were talking about. And also it was super useful not to come from HR. It was super useful to come from finance, because I am always passionate about how to create value, how to be ahead. No, it's not about recruiting. It's about creating an impact, a positive impact for a brand. So after 6 weeks, I left. And I started my own firm.
You left the executive firm, no?
I left this executive search firm and I create my own firm. So in fact, as you know, in France, we are very few women entrepreneurs. So I can say today that with my company, and I'm maybe also a serial entrepreneur because I am the founder of Eyes on Talents and of Ethics and Boards. So I'm very proud to be a woman entrepreneur in this country, because we are not that many.
What would, I mean, every brand differs a lot, and French people always talk about the DNA of a brand and how you have to respect that or sometimes revolutionize it. When you first were approached by a brand, what are the questions you ask them about what they're looking for? If we're talking about choosing a creative director.
So first I look at who is the shareholder.
Oh, really?
This is the most important point. Who is the shareholder? Is a shareholder thinking ahead? Is a shareholder someone we can trust? Is the shareholder investing in the company on the long term? And if so, we are working because we want to, you know, create impact and positive impact. If not, I mean, I'm very sorry, but I mean, we are not going to be able to work. So who is the shareholder and who is the CEO? And what is super interesting is really, I mean, to bring together a CEO and with the CEO and with the shareholder, creative director.
Okay.
Because it's not in silo. There is not a CEO on one side and a creative director. It's completely combined. And what is interesting today, and I will answer your question. What is interesting today is that it's not about creativity, it's about ideas. And a shareholder, a CEO, a creative director originate ideas. Look at Raymond Ruffini, who has just been honored as the business leader of the year, as the Fashion Awards in England. I was in the jury. I mean, he has transformed a very small French old brand, and 15 years later, it is a listed company that is doing extremely well through ideas. And of course, then he has research creatives that could help make these ideas
realize
these ideas. So the most important thing is having a shareholder, having a CEO who is not imitating the past, who is not looking back at what has worked, but who is able to understand the society, understand that today the paradigms are China, 35% of the luxury market, data, and we're at Luxury Insight here, data and ideas, or maybe ideas and data and the Chinese consumer. So ideas, ideas, ideas. Once you have positioned this, then you can partner and find the right creative resource or resources.
So what you're saying is the old idea of a creative director as a great illustrator who had a vision of women and could sketch that and had an idea of a deep dive into the brand and then sketching it, that's over, really.
Yes,
that period.
No,
they don't really need to sketch anymore.
But it has never been the case. It has never. Coco Chanel, Gabrielle Chanel was not sketching.
Yeah.
Miuccia Prada is not sketching. So we.
Yves Saint Laurent and Karl Lagerfeld were. Balenciaga did.
Yes. But you know what? It's interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Either you can.
Valentino certainly did.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Either you
Versace
can.
Versace did.
Either you can express with your hands your vision, or you can direct as a conductor in an orchestra. People who are experts. So it's about the idea. Someone who needs to sketch very well may never be a good creative director. So it's the idea first, and the idea that is connected with the society, because an idea that is disconnected with the society doesn't mean anything. So a creative director, when we are looking for a creative director, we or creative resources or a creative organization, we are looking for people who understand today, who understands the society, who understands...
When you say understand society and look society, I mean, besides the obvious, the Chinese millennium as the future market, artificial intelligence, algorithms, all that, what are the ideas you look for? I mean, give me some concrete examples of meeting a designer who said, these are my ideas for the brand.
For example, today, the question of beauty, the question of age, the question of gender. And so a shareholder, a CEO, a creative director, a designer who doesn't embrace those values is not part of our world of today.
Okay. He has to be open to change.
It's not open to change. He has to really... absolutely be le fer de lance of those values.
Okay.
Because it's just the world, fortunately, the world that we are living in today.
So you see, in a way, fashion and luxury playing a positive role.
I think that the luxury, I mean, the creative brand, what is luxury and not luxury? Oh. Apple is luxury, oh, right. Apple is not luxury. It's in terms of a very, at the end of the day, informed customer, and who wants things he can live with. Look at the success of Fenty, of Rihanna. Now she's the second brand worldwide in terms of lingerie. Her beauty is just exploding. Mm-hmm. And she's a creative. Virgil is a creative. Mm. Are there fashion designers? No. But they come with solutions for today's world. They are the ambassadors of today's world, and they come with products that are absolutely a response to today's world.
Okay. Do you think designers have to be 360 designers? They have to know how to do shows, ad campaigns, social media, stores, personal appearance, handle the media? Do you think that's part of the job description today?
No job description.
There isn't any job description.
No job description. And I think that, in any position, we should really eliminate job description. We should talk about what's the goal, what is to achieve. And if we change this mindset, it will never be about sticking to a job description. It will be, okay, what's the goal? At the end of the day, I want to come to make a company fair, and doing well and being fair. And I think that this is a very important statement today. But I mean, doing well, because then you can create employment, and being fair and acting in a fair manner in all way. So a creative director is someone who, as I said, has idea and can either express those idea in a physical or digital manner, or get the resources to express it. So to your point, if it is someone who is just sketching or just doing digital, it's not enough. It is really someone who has a whole vision. But I mean, like Balenciaga had a global vision, like Saint Laurent his time had a global vision, like Paul Smith had a global, like Calvin, like Nuccia had a global vision. So it's nothing new, but it just means that today the creative assets are just on any fronts, because everything is visible.
You were famous over your distinguished career of, you know, helping to find people like Christopher Bailey in Burberry or Albert Elbaz in Lanvin, among many others.
Daniel Schiaparelli recently, Gerardo, Roger Vivier, so many working on the assessment and the nomination of Alessandro Michele.
When you first went to, a lot of these people were not, some of them had a reputation and moved over to a big brand, but many of them were like people within the team. They were design directors or, you know, they were not stars. Mm. How did you find them?
Oh, we This is probably my finance background. We are super rational. I think that's the combination today between ideas and being very rational.
Yeah. So
having the ideas and what the brand stands for, what the brand stands for today, why was it successful and what will make it successful today, with a very rational work where we know and I have team to help me get to know who is doing what everywhere on every front, whether it is, of course, in fashion, but in beauty, in jewelry, in photography, in architecture, in digital, in all fronts. And so we know the number two and we know the number three, and this is part of our...
Your scouting that you do.
Yes.
Okay. It's not so much them coming to you, younger designers, just getting their resume into your hand.
Oh, yes. It is on both sides. But if they do not, we also watch. We are super, super organized. So we really start to watch them from graduation and from also awards. And that's the reason why I also launched Eyes on Talents, which is our company digital platform, which helps brands who want also to research by themselves, creative, but also now managers. But at Eyes on Talents, we have graduates, all the graduates. And as now, I launched it years ago, we have very senior people as well. Because today, you may be working on a consulting basis or in-house. So it could be project.
How many people work for your company now?
For Florian de Saint-Pierre et Associés, we are around 12, 13, 14. And we are based in three locations. We are in Paris, we are in Milan, and we are in New York. And we are traveling all the time. And we are namely, I think that we have never opened an office in London because we love to come to London. And it's very easy.
And in Eyes on Talent, that includes Eyes on Talent.
So Eyes on Talent is another company.
Yeah.
And in fact, we had many requests from creative and managers that we... couldn't address, and we had requests from clients that we decided also couldn't take due to, time. So we decided to have a digital platform where it's by invitation. We have, wonderful talent that we invite. It's very visual, and of course, it's on structured data. So you can research people by his or her school, by the number of years of experience, by any kind of hard criteria, but also by visual, because everything today is visual. You are launching a perfume, it's visual, and you're a marketing director. You're a creative that has designed a bottle of the perfume. You need to express visually. So it's very, very visual.
The historically, of course, I know designers who've discussed to me how they got big jobs, and there was often 4, 5, or 6 meetings, often for the LGH companies, there could be 10, you could go just to become, not even the creative director of a brand, but a design director or the men's designer, you'd go through a lot of meetings. Nowadays in the digital era, there's a lot less of that. You know what I mean? You're showing people's talent through visuals, as you say. Has it happened that some people have been appointed without ever meeting their future bosses?
No.
Not
there
quite.
Is always a physical meeting. But what is interesting is that it's open. It gives fair opportunities. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, you may be based in New York. And through a digital platform, you may see someone who is based in Japan, and who is doing the most exquisite, I have in mind, the most exquisite pieces of craft. And then... you decide to have a conversation with this person and then to meet this person. So in fact, it just open the possibilities of reaching out to people who are, who doesn't necessarily want to live in large cities or who have practices that are less visible. So it really opens.
Okay. How, if a young person is approaching Florian Saint-Pierre or a brand, for their first interview or the first discussion about what they want to do in their career. Can you give me five do's and five don'ts about the early meeting?
Five do's is be yourself, be yourself, be yourself, be yourself. These are four do's. Now, I think that be yourself and think, always think about what your dream is.
What your dream is.
What your dream is. Because it's always my question.
Yeah.
What is your dream?
Yeah.
And this is the only question I cannot answer. And some people tell me, oh, I mean, I've not thought about this question. And I said, you know what? Do not let anyone think and answer this question for you. Sometimes people told me, you know what? No, I cannot share with you my dream because it's so far away from our industry. And I said, you know what? I mean, up to you if you wish to. And just sharing their dreams or their passion, I said, but you know what? Then I have a client that would be super interested to meet with you because you realize that when people has a passion, when someone has a passion, this person is so knowledgeable. And I remember a story of someone who was working for Sony, and this person was a pen collector.
A pen collector.
And it's just through asking this question. It was years ago, so that's why I can disclose the story. It was years ago. And I asked this question, what is your passion? What is your dream? And this person told me, you know what, it's very far away from our conversation, and said, I mean, if you wish. And then this person said, you know what? I am a pen collector. And said, how come you're a pen collector? And this person knew everything about pen. And I was just recruiting the head of the handwriting instruments for the most important brand in the sector.
Yeah.
And this person got the job in a minute.
Because he had the passion. That was...
And he has the knowledge and he has a passion.
When we first met, when we were both starting off, I mean, you had been, you were a headhunter when I first met you.
Yes.
So you'd done a few years, I know you'd opened your business maybe. But when I arrived in fashion, the media had a lot more power than it does today. You know, the Vogues, my old boss, Mr. Fairchild, was where Daily was the Bible, everyone was scared of them. How do you think that change in the reporter force between the brands and the media has changed the way creativity and brands behave?
I think that we've experienced the same change because, I mean, it's the access to information.
Yeah.
Before, to access information, you needed to read a media.
Yeah. Oh.
So you were owning the information.
Yeah,
the information couldn't be accessible otherwise.
Yeah.
As for us, it was the pre-LinkedIn, so knowing who was doing what where, you had to go through us.
Yeah.
Now it's a world where information is available, and anyone in the street can get an information and put it live.
Yeah.
However, what has a value as a media, what has a value for us, is the idea and the brain.
Yeah.
So in fact, the context, the analysis, and this is not putting and shaping, contextualizing information is something that is very unique, and only, I mean, people with a lot of culture and a great media background can do it. As for us, I mean, anyone, every talent manager who is on his LinkedIn every day can know who is doing what where.
Yeah.
However, the idea to take this person or this person, I mean, is part of the value we create.
Do you think the approval, the approbation of the trade publications, Women's Wear Daily, Business Fashion, Fashion Network, or the magazines still count when people are making their opinion about who they're going to hire and how they want to operate?
I think that these publications are super important and still super meaningful. I read Women's Wear Daily every day or every minute, where every time there is a breaking news.
Yeah.
I read Business of Fashion every day. So because it is aggregated, filtered, aggregated, and contextualized. So I think there is always be room for smart information that is aggregated and contextualized.
Okay. Do you, there was a moment for me, a kind of, when Alexandra Michele came on board in Gucci, where, I mean, I thought it was a breath of fresh air, but a lot of the daily newspapers didn't really warm to the idea. Whereas the influencers and bloggers immediately liked it. And there was a kind of change in tide, where all of a sudden there was a new jury out there. What do you see the role of influencers in terms of influencing the choice of the designers who will be creating?
Honestly, I remember I was part of the assessment of Alessandro. I was at, of course, at his first show, and I was sitting, sitting to. In fact, I was sitting in the media section, and everybody was. He's not even done the show before they were criticizing, say, I don't understand why it was not X, Y, Z. And so suddenly I said, this industry is very strange. Super strange. They have a preconceived idea. And then and then there was an immediate support from the audience because, I mean, of course, he was bringing someone, not only in terms of design, but in terms of ideas, was challenging beauty, questioning beauty, questioning gender, questioning age, questioning repositioning Italy also. So... In fact, your question is interesting because it shows that the audience, the bloggers, the influencers are now more, maybe more qualified or more educated than people in media who might have preconceived ideas. So I think that it's a really a wake-up call for media to say no preconceived ideas. We're not at a time anymore of preconceived ideas.
In the modern society, we talk about algorithms and artificial intelligence. I'm sometimes permanently shocked when I even just have a conversation with someone about something. Within 48 hours, I'm getting an ad. I don't quite, you know, it's nearly a magical power. How in a scary kind of way sometimes. How do you think that will affect creativity in the future going ahead?
It can affect creativity massively. I think that it doesn't affect ideas, strangely. It doesn't affect ideas. It can affect creativity. So it means the execution of ideas. Mm-hmm. Only because, I mean, when you have data, masses, million, billion of data, then it's very tempting to produce products or services that respond to this data. So this is super dangerous because otherwise you are always a little bit about backwards about existing data. And then the next step is, of course, maybe data can be, you can have a data that can predict the future. So I think that it's probably a world that we have already entered massively on many, 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 many fronts. And I do think that, I mean, ideas, especially ideas that resonate with society and creativity will always a little bit escape to this. Because, I mean, part of it will be dictated by data. But, I mean, an Alessandro Michele, for example, I'm not sure that he will, I mean, part of the collection may respond to data. But really, the idea that makes the difference will not come from data, I don't think.
Good. In the last 10, 20 years, especially the last 10, large investment groups have decided to include fashion luxury in their portfolio, you know, as well with defense industries and technology. They all feel they need to have 2, 3, 5% of their portfolio in this world. And we see not many brands have been bought. When you're dealing with companies like that, Permira or the Qatari Investment Fund or whoever you deal with, how does that change the way you operate and who you suggest should work there?
I think that there are really two a different kind of investors through a split. The investors that know, that have already, I mean, invested in fashion and luxury since many, many years, they are super prepared. They know that it's for the long term. And they have many investments in this area, and they know what it means, and they are super, super equipped. Then you have investors that where fashion represents just one part of their portfolio. It's very important to understand whether it is a short-term or long-term. If it's on the long-term, then it means that they are ready to take the necessary steps and then know that it will not be a quick win in a minute. Everybody is dreaming of making a Gucci. However, it's very, 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 very unique. Short-term is not part of this industry. So I'm very careful when we take a client just to make sure that they understand that this industry is not about short-term.
There are many examples of designers who don't work hard and are of designers who do very interesting collections, but it still doesn't work. Are designers condemned today now to have to always have double-digit growth of minimum 15-20%, otherwise you're not really doing your job? Or, you know, is there a future for...
This is a very interesting question. And I think that we should, on many fronts, question growth. What means growth? What means sustainability? What means fair play, fair game, fair share, fair share as well for the suppliers, fair share for the employees. So all this fair game for the planet, I mean, about sustainability. So I think I'm not naive, and I know that when you're a listed group, it's super difficult, I mean, to escape from the pressure of the market. However, I think that it's time to value this long-term brands that are not just about growth, but about, I would say, more about the quality of their brand. The quality of their brand, it means that that the brand is, years after years, still very meaningful. But while we are talking about that, I think that there is also a very important ingredient that will come in the mix, is that now we are today, we have a world that is shaped by Western brand and Japanese designer.
A little bit, right?
A little bit. No.
But a significant point in terms of creativity.
In terms of creativity and in terms of influence. They've been, and they are, super important. However, now that we see that 35% of the consumers are Chinese, and not to mention, I mean, all the countries around China, maybe in the next decade, we will see as well brands that will come and designers who will come. In the film industry, we have wonderful directors. Member of the board of the Amis de Pompidou, and I was there for the opening of the Centre Pompidou with Bund. There are key...
Centre Pompidou?
West Bund in Shanghai.
Oh, yes, okay. Well, they have a Centre Pompidou on the Bund in Shanghai.
It's a collaboration between the West Bund Museum and the Centre Pompidou that was just opened in November. And they are amazing Chinese artists. My question is, when do we see as well non-Western designers or brands that will, you know, be...
Do you go to many fashion shows?
No. Yes and no.
How many do you go to a year?
It's a matter of time. My team do many, 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 many fashion shows, but also, more important than fashion shows, it's a studio visit. Because, I mean, studio visit, I mean, to see how designers work is super important. So I do, per seasons, I would do a key 10 key shows. But my team, I have a dedicated team that do not only shows, but also visiting studios and visiting graduations.
But you probably only go to 50 shows a year.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay. I go to 500 a year. I must have been to 10,000 at least in my life. Not many people have been to more shows than me. In all my, and I've been to Brazil, to Rio, to the BRICS, you know, the big countries. Sao Paulo, Moscow, St. Petersburg, Shanghai, Beijing. I have yet to see a designer from any of the BRICS who's going to be the next great new thing. Why do you think that is? You say that in artistic world, there are many great modern Chinese artists. Ai Weiwei is probably the top five artists in the world today. There are many important filmmakers from Russia. There are great architects from Brazil. There are Indians in technology. But in fashion, we don't see that in the brick. Why do you think that is?
I don't think that I have the answer. No, but it's interesting. I mean, I don't think that I have the answer. Because, I mean, when we really put the question as in many creative fields, we have major creative minds, especially in art, film. I mean, why not in fashion? So I do not have the answer. Because it's not necessarily about schools. I mean, many designers have not graduated at school, so it's not necessarily school. So I do not have the answer. However, I'm convinced that it will happen. I mean, for sure.
Is democracy part of it? The idea of a certain sense of individual freedom and expression, the lack of concern about the vicarious of power. Maybe does that play a role in the fact that those countries have not...
I'm not sure, because in fact you've seen, you have often seen very interesting artists coming from countries that are under political constraints.
Yes, but we're talking about fashion and luxury, not so much pure.
But
art.
Even if you think about Demna, who grew up in a country which...
Yes, that's a fair point.
Yes, and who, I mean, who...
His country was invaded.
You know. Yes, invaded, I mean, was under, I mean, huge political constraints, and who has, I mean, this has nurtured his creativity, at least he, I mean, refers to what he has, to the environment he has grown up.
Yes, his hometown in Abkhazia was invaded by Russians or separatists, and he's when certain times you were talking about the obligation for growth being this maybe unnecessary belief, but I'm thinking of designers who have made impressive shows, but somehow not immediately gained traction. In the more recent past, Riccardo Tisci. Unquestionably a great designer. He's done very interesting things in Burberry, but somehow not so much traction commercially. Why do you think certain designers, I'm not saying he doesn't work, but for the moment, in certain houses don't work out? What do you think is there?
I think, we're watching usually is that it always takes a little while for the market to adapt.
Yeah, yeah.
Always, always a little while. And the biggest, the biggest demand is, I mean, it takes a little time. So I think that what Riccardo and what Marco are bringing, Marco Gobetti and Riccardo Tisci are bringing to Burberry is really, I mean, this repositioning on creativity, ideas, and quality. And then you need also this execution on a large scale. Yeah. So because it means also, I mean, reassessing the suppliers. So there is a lot of behind hard work, behind the scenes work that is currently done. So that's why I was mentioning earlier short-term versus long-term. Shareholders of the stock market, in this case, shareholders need to understand that fashion is not quick.
Yeah.
It's not quick. Because, I mean, especially now where there is this fast on everything, then you need, I mean, people to get, again, their attention on your brand.
The great buzzword of today is sustainability. And fashion has come under a lot of attacks in the last several years, especially... I think beginning with Livia First's famous documentary about the pollution is created in manufacturing and cleaning and creating and travel. And so not a day passes in my office when I get an email from someone telling me about their sustainability project. Do you really think there has been a major movement, or as the French say, it's the long du bois, that people are just paying lip service to this?
I think it's even broader than that. I think that sustainability is just a pillar that should have been addressed since years.
Yeah.
I mean, we were just like this. And so once again, it's when the audience is talking, when the consumer is talking, that companies probably organize. But so now they are talking about sustainability, and it's time for action and for results. And it's good because, I mean, most of them are really addressing this in a very efficient manner. However, I think that there are other fields of the for purpose of for fair that is super important. How do you treat your suppliers? Because if you're buying direct or purchasing direct has a bonus on delaying the payment of suppliers, this is not a fair thing to do. So I think that there is sustainability, but sustainability is part of a bigger picture, which is about, I mean, fair. And I think this
being
is
fair.
Yeah. Fair to your employees, fair to the planet, fair to all the stakeholders. Fair, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, at Eyes on Talents, we are the partner, as you know, of Paris Good Fashion.
Yeah.
So we launched call for applications on our... so we have a lot of philanthropic initiatives. This is a part of a philanthropic initiative for Paris Good Fashion. And we have launched a call for applications about differently abled people. And so this is a topic that is very little addressed by fashion companies. So how does fashion or accessories address differently abled people, disabled people? And so the response of this call for application was absolutely amazing. This was announced at the Institut Français de la Mode last June, and we had four laureates. One of them was already awarded at Festival d'Hier. Is someone who has designed jewelry, and so that if you are not hearing well, you can have a beautiful piece of jewelry. Another one was, working on accessories that you can put on wheelchair so that you can have your bag or you can have your cup of coffee. So there is a lot of things that could be done and that are not part of today's world.
How do you see the role of awards, prizes? There's like been an explosion of them in the last several years, you know, from Pierre to LVMH to Andam, Vogue, CFDA, British Awards, you know. You're nearly at fault if you don't have an award ceremony. What is the role of that in the industry?
Visibility is key today. So everything that helps... a leader, whether he or she is a creative leader or a business leader, get more visibility is super helpful. Because there are so many that, in fact, having a jury of qualified people who say, okay, our eyes are on this work, and this work is interesting, gives a lot of visibility. So it is super useful, especially at a time when creative people needs to find the resources to sustain their own company. So, immediately when they have a visibility, they have had a little bit more traction from, stores, from key players.
About 25 years ago, I wrote a story for W Magazine. It was a big four-page broadsheet story, which a lot of people reacted to, and it was called The Rich, Rich, Rich Designers, of how, it was one of the few mechanisms that a person would become very wealthy very quickly and live like a Renaissance prince, and the example was Versace or Armani. Do you think with the entrance into more corporate groups, LVMH, Kering, Vendôme, and Richemont, and also financial capital, that the returns, the payments to the designers, have gotten less? Because I think they have.
I would not answer your question right away, but it leads me to answer in a different way.
Okay.
I question who, during his or her life, will be able to build a company of the size of a Calvin, of a Ralph, or a Versace, or a Miuccia. And this is a key question.
Has that era gone?
Maybe. I mean, at least I do not see it.
Yeah.
Because I see very talented designers. Mm-hmm. We're talking about them now. We're talking. But I do not see company of this size anymore.
Yes, the last,
in a lifetime.
The last young designers who did it are who? Dolce & Gabbana in their 50s.
Probably Dolce & Gabbana. Probably yeah. Dolce & Gabbana.
Is that the last?
Dries, but it's not at the same
size. And
he
already sold out.
Right. But if you think about this generation that has built, I mean, companies of the size of a Ralph, of a Calvin, of a Miuccia,
of an Armani,
of a Valentino, of an Armani. So the question, my question is...
Tommy Hilfiger.
How come
it
doesn't happen?
Well, how come? You should be the expert here. I mean, what is your explanation?
I think that probably one of the explanation is the changes of society. And probably I would say that the one who are managing it, probably there are a few, but completely in a different business model would be, I would say, Off-White.
Yes.
And Fenty. And
yes.
Supreme. Yeah. So these are the one who have built, I mean, companies of a large scale, very quickly.
Out of nowhere, yeah.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
And they are still young. So the company can even become bigger. So what is super interesting is that, in fact, they are focused on ideas and creativity. Mm. Ideas. This stands for something.
Yeah.
It's a value that is expressed through product. So ideas and values. Then the execution of the product, whether it is... furniture like Virgil, whether it is fashion, whether it is any kind of product. And in fact, they have not focused on distribution.
Yeah.
Distribution is operated by, I mean, a company like the New Guards or partner. Yeah. I mean, Fenty has a partnership with LVMH.
Yeah.
So they have focused, quite interesting, because their business model is different.
Yeah.
They are focused on the creative ideas, I mean, the ideas.
Well, I'd say two things about both of them. First of all, my understanding was when New Guards was bought by Farfetch, that Virgil Abloh ended up getting nothing because he owned the brand, but they sold the license. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really profit. He almost seems to have walked out of the brand, and certainly for the foreseeable future. So... unfortunately for him, it seems unfair, but that's my understanding. And in the case of Fenty, I would have thought possibly, arguably, for once Bernard Arnault didn't make the greatest deal in the world, the best deal maker of them all, the most intelligent businessman in the industry, because he owns, or he's a partner in her couture, you know, streetwear brand, but she owns the underwear business. How do you react to that?
I just react to that to see that probably I will take the other way around. The other way around to see, in fact, if it would be easy, or maybe in terms of business model, to say that today, I mean, is it possible for a creative mind to be able to produce and distribute, I mean, through digital e-commerce or whatever, on his or on her own? Apparently not. Apparently not. Apparently not.
So that era maybe...
Yes, and in fact, what is important, probably the most important thing, is that key creatives can express their values through product or services. So this is the most important thing. It's not the how, probably. It is the what.
How does it change? In a sense, the role model is more now someone like Karl Lagerfeld, who always said he was a gun for hire, you know, whether it was Fendi or Chanel. His own brand, historically, until very recently, was very modest affair. And that seems to be the career path of most of the young designers coming out of the better schools. They want to be hired and eventually become creative director of an existing brand and take it to somewhere new. How does that change creativity?
Do you know what's interesting? Because you do many graduation.
Yeah, yeah.
My team do many graduation, and I do many juries. I think I see most of them who are willing to start their own line. Let's take the example in the UK. Look at the Greg Green. Look at the Richard Quinn. Look before the Simon Rochard.
Mary Catransu.
Mary Catransu.
I mean,
they, in fact, they are very smart.
Yeah.
They have their own line.
Yeah.
They are sustainable.
Yeah.
Most of them are self-financed, and yeah. they are not small anymore.
And they own the business.
They own their business.
Yeah.
And they are, because, I mean, they are great talent.
Yeah.
Financially sound, and then they can pick and choose the consulting that are good for their brand.
Yeah.
For example, Moncler has reached out to Simon Rochard, to Greg Green, to Richard Quinn.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a very, very good win-win situation on both sides.
Mm.
But I think it's a very, very, and what I see is that most of them in France, you see Marine Serre and Christelle Cochet.
And Jacques Emus.
And Jacques Emus, who is doing extremely well, who are taking this path.
Yeah. So do you think any of those will ever grow into global brands? In 30 years' time, will our kids be, or our grandkids be, you know, in those stores?
But
buying those clothes or looking for that look?
But maybe they do not want to. Do you see what I mean? Probably they want to have the sustainable growth.
Yes, but you could say Versace or Armani had sustainable growth. So they kept ownership for... until very recently, for example, Armani still owns it.
Yes, but I think that you can never say this designer should do like this other one. I think that this is because I was starting this conversation talking about the business side and the shareholder.
Yeah.
They are the shareholder. It's very interesting because they are not only creative people, but they're also their majority shareholder.
Yeah, yeah.
So in fact, they are taking the path
that
they feel right for the company.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it will be, I mean, a company of this size,
yeah.
and not a global mega brand with perfumes and lingerie. But at the end of the day, it will be more sustainable on the long term.
Do you think that's also partly because the new generation, like many people, now regard fashion as an art form, in part? So they think of themselves as much as artists as...
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's what changed the perception? Because the older designers didn't think of themselves as artists, but now there's all these exhibitions at prestigious museums. So, you know, Richard Prada, I don't think, thinks of herself as an artist. Most people would, but she doesn't.
I don't think that fashion is art, but I think that fashion includes the highest level of creativity.
Yeah.
And designers can include... They are the one who decide the highest level of craft.
Yeah.
When you think about a Richard Quinn, it's obvious. A Greg Green, it's absolutely obvious.
Yeah.
So I think that there is this craft that it can be different. I mean, there is a combination between art and craft as well. No? But I don't think that the intention is to do a unique piece that you will not wear. I think that all these designers want... their work to be, I mean, people's body at the end of the day. However, that it includes creativity, that it includes craft, yes.
Final thing, the names you mentioned in Paris and London who have built sustainable, you know, help probably by the internet that, you know, certainly Net-a-Porter and these other, or Farfetch or Matches or Maitreese have all been very important in sustaining these young designers, in my view. But they've built sustainable businesses that sell in 100 to 300 doors or 500 doors, whatever. That hasn't happened in Milan or London so much. The generation in New York who are meant to be the new stars, is that close and closest business? Princess Guler don't seem to be doing so well. There's not a new generation. In Milan, despite all the best efforts, the Cameron, La Moda and everyone, there hasn't been a new generation. Why do you think Paris and London have managed to have that new generation, but not the other two capitals?
It's an interesting question. Probably because, I mean, Paris... like London, have been able to attract people from all over the world. Because if you think about Demna, has not even graduated in France. But he has, I mean, he has chosen Paris. Yeah, he has came here. So, and this has always been the case. If we think about the Nina Ricci, the Balenciaga, I mean, all these designers came to Paris. So, or call. So it's more the power of attracting creative talents in some specific places. Then you will tell me why Paris and why London. So because maybe there is a context about very open culture in every field, whether it is contemporary art, dance, performance, music, where people feel, excited to live or to be part of.
Final question, Paris, you're French. I'm an Irishman, lives in Paris, it's my home. We run around the fashion seasons. You know, fashion is like golf or tennis. There's four Grand Slam tournaments in there, Paris, London, New York, and Milan. Why is it, though, that Paris and the French have managed to maintain this leadership, that it's, for men, women, couture, it's the biggest season and the biggest brand somewhere here?
I would say two things. Private initiatives, and I think that we have to thank shareholders like Mr. Arnault, like François-Henri Pinault, to have chosen incredible talent for their houses. So part of it is that, because, I mean, when you have incredible talent at the helm of houses coming from all over the world, then, of course, it attracts to the city and to the fashion shows that are here. Then I think that we have also to be grateful to some political initiatives or to the Chambre syndicale that has really decided years ago, Paris, capitale de la création. And Paris, capitale de la création was on every front, whether it is design, architecture, film, performance, initiatives like Le 104 in Paris, like the Palais de Tokyo. All these initiatives have really boosted and built La FIAC, Paris Photo, all these, you know, branding, but it's not just about branding, it's about content of Paris being the capital where you can experience and see the best creatives. So I think it is really being fortunate to have shareholders who have been able and were able to pick up every time the best talent and governmental initiatives that have decided really to support creativity on all fronts.
Florian de Saint-Père, our half hour conversation has turned into nearly an hour. But I've enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you, Godfrey. Thank you. It's always a pleasure. We could go on.
And I hope our listeners enjoyed it as much as I have.
Thank you so much. As always, I enjoy so much, sharing and exchanging views with you. Thank you, Godfrey.
My pleasure.